Hi, my name is Emma. I live in New York City, and I've recently noticed something. A tension in this country. Well, not just this country, because that part is obvious, but on a sort of cellular level here. I see it in my city, in my school, even within my own family. The issue with the Arab-Israeli conflict in America is that we can't speak. Kids in my generation, I think we're really cynical. And I can recognize my position of privilege when I say that despite everything, the beauty of this country is that discussion is encouraged. Our countless cruel and disheartening failures can't take that away, I hope. But now there's a kind of silence weighing on us here. This isn't an issue of freedom of speech, but instead a self-inflicted and perpetuating silence. It's rooted in fear and, quite frankly, ignorance. When we deign to talk about this issue, we fear coming across as racist or hateful, when in reality, all we want is an open conversation. The real root of the problem, however, is the utter lack of knowledge. I see it at my school and more obviously in myself. I have these conversations and I find myself tripping over my words, grappling for some unknown statistic or fact. Some basis for my argument, yet I'm at a loss. In an effort to curtail these feelings of both passion and complete ignorance, I searched the podcast app. I typed in Arab-Israeli conflict, expecting some onslaught of interesting and understandable pieces that could really break it down for me. I found absolutely nothing. There was no podcast devoted to the problem and the problem alone. At no point during this series will I claim to know more than the next person, and more importantly, I will refrain from revealing any bias. The reason I'm talking to you today is merely to educate both myself and anyone who feels hopelessly ignorant. This is the Arab-Israeli conflict explained. So I guess we'll just jump right into it. Here we go. Episode 1. We'll start out just before World War I. But I'm not going to go so far back because the conflict isn't as historic as it's made out to be. The Ottomans ruled over the land that was once called Palestine. Their reign lasted about 400 years, from 1517 to 1917, when the empire fell because of World War I. The area at the time was pretty religiously diverse, and it was home to Muslims, Christians, and Jews. According to the Ottoman population records, of 1878, 87% of the population was Muslim, 10% was Christian, and 3% was Jewish. Interestingly, however, in Jerusalem, which is considered a holy land for all three religions, the populations were about equal. The Ottoman Empire is considered pretty stable and prosperous by scholars. They took control in 1453, when they seized Constantinople, which was the capital of the Byzantine Empire at the time. Under Selim, Palestine was brought under Ottoman control in around 1517. Historians regard the empire as religiously tolerant. If you weren't Muslim, you were part of the millet system, which gave other religious groups a limited ability to govern themselves, though they were still under Ottoman rule. So things were generally peaceful, and that's a pretty broad statement, but we're just going to go with it. As a side note, I'm just going to assume that as listeners and learners, we know absolutely nothing, because I don't know anything, quite frankly. So I'm going to briefly explain what Zionism is and how it influenced the modern conflict. I'll go into some historic details and we'll talk about Theodor Herzl. Herzl was a Jewish, fairly secular Jewish journalist who saw the intense anti-Semitism that was prevalent in Europe at the time. He initially believed that the only way, and this is pretty crazy, to end anti-Semitism was to convert to Christianity. So he was basically arguing for a mass Jewish conversion, which would have been completely crazy and unrealistic. He kind of toyed with how to solve anti-Semitism, but he was really pushed over the edge during something called the Dreyfus Affair. From my understanding of it, there was this guy, Alfred Dreyfus, who was an assimilated Jewish officer in the French army. He was accused of espionage, or was actually framed for espionage. At the time of his trial, Herzl was working as a journalist in France, and he saw the crowd outside of the trial chanting "Death to the Jew." I guess you could say he had somewhat of an epiphany in that moment. He realized that if someone of Dreyfus's stature and success could be taken down by anti-Semitism, something extreme had to be done. He believed anti-Semitism would never die out if things went on as they were. So he came up with this idea that Jews would basically move back to their historic homeland in Palestine. Now keep in mind, when I say historic homeland, I mean that they once lived there between about 1000 BCE and 70 CE, before they were exiled by the Romans. He thought this mass movement would end anti-Semitism because the Jewish people would finally have a land to call their own, and they wouldn't sort of interfere with life as usual in Europe, which is kind of awful because they felt like they had to evacuate to be accepted. He wrote something called The Jewish State, which was a pamphlet, and it had another German name that I just can't pronounce, so I'm not going to attempt to. But interestingly enough, although he's sort of crowned as the father of Zionism, that word actually existed decades before he wrote The Jewish State. This concept, this movement, has been around since the 60s, or the 1860s, not the 1960s. Many Jews had been moving into what was the Ottoman-controlled Palestine for a while. They were kind of reviving Jewish culture and the Hebrew language. They moved either because of religious persecution back in Europe or for other religious reasons, since it was their religious homeland after all. So maybe Herzl didn't coin the term Zionism, but what you can give him credit for is that he revived a movement and made it more popular as he traveled around Europe and tried to garner support. So that's kind of a brief history of Zionism and Theodor Herzl, and now we're looking at this new lust for a Jewish homeland, and there's actually quite a few Jews living in Palestine already. Now here's where things get really interesting, and when the British come in and really screw it up. Basically, there was this guy, the British Foreign Secretary, named Arthur Balfour. His last name probably sounds familiar. You probably heard about him in your 11th grade U.S. history course. But he basically sent a letter to Lord Walter Rothschild, a super fancy name. He was the leader of the British Zionist Federation. I mean, clearly Zionism was becoming more popular. There was a whole federation devoted to it now. In this letter, sent on November 2nd, 1917, Balfour said he had sympathy for the Zionist cause and for these quote-unquote Jewish Zionist aspirations. He promised the establishment of a national home for the Jewish people in Palestine. This is a good time to mention that the Balfour Declaration included the line, quote, that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine. Anyway, in sending this letter, he sort of made Zionism a part of the British foreign policy. Unfortunately for Balfour, this declaration was kind of illegal. The British had no right to give land away. They had no authority to establish a home state in an area that they didn't control. Keep in mind, the region Palestine was still under Ottoman control at this time. Funnily enough, just a few weeks later, the British conquered Jerusalem in the flurry of World War I. So now, under the Balfour Declaration, you'd think that the land would kind of just be handed over to the Jewish people. Unfortunately, the British had promised a few people that exact same strip of land. First off, you have the Balfour Declaration, and then you have a secret agreement with the French. It was called the Sykes-Picot Agreement, and Britain and France were going to divide up the Arab territories. Some other British officials promised the ruler of Mecca, Sharif Hussein bin Ali, that he would rule over the Arab states, including Palestine, as well. All he had to do was lead an Arab revolt against the Ottoman Caliphate, which, guess what, he did. Ultimately, the British did honor the Balfour Agreement, eventually controlling land that was called the British Mandate of Palestine. They even facilitated Jewish immigration to Palestine. They did this by immediately giving Jewish immigrants a Palestinian passport upon arrival. Now we're coming to the close of this first episode, but as a sort of concluding statement, it's important to note that as Jews came flooding in to a land that was made up of mostly Christians and Muslims, I'll give you the statistics, 92% of the population was Muslim and Christian, meaning that 8% was Jewish. Tensions were really heightened, and you might consider this the beginning of the hostility between these two groups. In 1936, Palestinians revolted and rioted in Jaffa and Tel Aviv. The uprising is often called the Arab Revolt or the Great Revolt, and the goal was to fight British control over Palestine and the open-door policy that they had towards Jewish immigration. The revolt ended in brutal suppression on the part of the British, and just 12 years later, in May of 1948, the British leave Palestine. Now we have this land that is already being fought over, and on top of that, Zionist paramilitary armies were planning on colonizing all of historic Palestine. 700,000 local Palestinians were removed from their ancestral homes, and 15,000 Palestinians were killed in massacres. Zionists declared their own state on May 4, 1948. There are two peoples laying claim to the same tiny New Jersey-sized piece of land, and now one has declared it their state. Stick around for the next episode because things get really crazy from here on out when the UN gets involved in the already messy, violent conflict in the Middle East.